Chapter 99. Stadtholder King William III. Though our little prince is ever so small, yet he shall be stadtholder after all. Thus sang the people when John de Witt ruled, being assisted thereby by his friends, the proud regents. A stadtholder? No. No more stadtholders. We are able to do it ourselves. Thus thought and spoke the Lord Regents after the death of stadtholder William II, who had died suddenly of the chicken pox. John de Witt, the grand pensionary, agreed with that. He himself had a dislike for the House of Orange. Had not his father, Jacob de Witt, been locked up in prison at the castle of Loewestein? That was done by the stadtholder, William II. And lo, John de Witt never forgave the House of Orange for that. Therefore he thought it best that also the regents no longer desired a stadtholder. That was exactly what he wanted. And yet it resounded throughout the land, and through the royal residence city of The Hague, sometimes so loud that he heard it. Though our little prince is ever so small, yet he shall be stadtholder after all. Then John de Witt just laughed. Ah, that ignorant people! They knew no better. And yet, no, he did not think it very pleasant. Those words, however innocent they sounded, had after all a somber threat in them. At times he even shuddered. Something unpleasant took hold of him. Our little prince? Who was he? Yea, there was a little prince, the future stadtholder, William III. That little boy never had a happy youth. He had never known his father. He was born 1 week after William II had died, so suddenly. From his childhood he was a pale, delicate little boy who coughed a lot. He certainly will not become old, was the fear of thousands of people in the country who were kindly disposed toward the House of Orange. Secretly, the regents hoped he would die. It had been a great disappointment to them that the widow of William II had not given birth to a daughter. But ah, in those days, so many small children died, especially those that were not strong. And strong? No, this little prince was not strong. Perhaps this child would also die while young. But that did not happen, because God watched over that child. The King of Kings had reserved a great task for that weak little boy. That little William would become an instrument in the hand of God to protect the Lord's church against the fierce onslaughts of Rome. From his sixth year he was brought up by his grandmother, Amelia van Solms, the widow of Stadtholder Frederick Henry. The God-fearing preacher, Reverend Trickland, has also been one of his tutors. In 1665, he became child of the state. From now on, the state would take care of his education. It was especially John de Witt who has forced that through. They were nice words, but in reality, he became a prisoner of the state. His best friends were removed from him, and enemies came in their place. You may be sure that the young prince has deeply felt that humiliation. Yet he kept silence and waited. The entire purpose of John de Witt was to make that orange child harmless. That child must not especially become prominent. John de Witt did instruct him in various subjects which he might need in later life. However, he never had any love for his pupil. On the contrary, he always treated him with a cold haughtiness. The prince resigned himself, worked hard, and abided his time, because he realized that a great task was assigned to him. How do we know that? Well, at one time, Reverend Trigland heard him pray that the Lord would strengthen him so that later he would be enabled to protect God's church. Who can say what transpired within the heart of William III? Thus the years passed by, years of loneliness for the young William III, because he was surrounded by men who were hostily inclined toward him and used every means to prevent that he would ever become stadtholder. He could never unburden his mind to them. Never did he have a confidential conversation with them. All that he ever received was cold haughtiness. In 1667, John DeWitt forced the Perpetual Edict, through in which was stipulated that a stadtholder would never again rule in Holland. The stadtholdership was abolished forever. Again, a victory for John DeWitt. Just let that ignorant people sing, though our little prince is ever so small. He shall see to it that it shall never happen. The prince himself remained silent at that new humiliation and studied. As firm as a rock, he believed that not John DeWitt, but that God reigned. Seemingly willing and submissive, the prince subjected himself to all those measures. He never permitted it to appear what transpired within him. John DeWitt himself said of this that William III was hard to fathom. How gladly would he have known what was hidden behind that apparent placid face and behind that high brow of his pupil. But William III kept silence. William also cherished no love for his teacher. And then, suddenly, great commotion prevails in The Hague, yea, in all cities and villages of the Republic of the Seven United Netherlands. All places of employment are empty. All schools are closed. Everywhere on the streets and on the roads, the people group together. Their faces are serious and somber, and they discuss with each other the events which, as an avalanche, succeed each other. Which events? Just ask those nervous people who have left their work and want to unburden their mind. They shall surely tell us, and then things shall be made worse than they already are. Thus it happens always in times of war, isn't that so? War had broken out, and the wildest rumors were being spread around. Be that as it may, that which alarmed the people was bad enough. The Republic of the Seven United Netherlands was threatened with destruction. In that fearful year of 1672, that country was attacked by four enemies at once. Powerful France had made an alliance with England, Westphalia, and Cologne. The French marched with a powerful army at Lobith across the border. A traitor showed the French army a shallow place in the Rhine, through which the powerful enemy could cross the river on foot. In a short time, the troops of Westphalia and Cologne conquered the entire eastern part of the Netherlands. Because their army had been so awfully neglected, scarcely no resistance was offered in those eastern provinces. Treason, cowardice, and despondency made it very easy for the enemy. Those Westphalian and Cologne troops even appeared before the city of Groningen, and it was besieged by them. No, the prospects were not very bright. A landing from the united English and French fleets threatened in the west, and the worst of it all was, we just mentioned it, treason everywhere. One fortress after another surrendered itself without a blow. We shall not relate this entire war, because that belongs to the national history. Yet I may not omit this part, because God's church was also greatly and most closely involved in that terrible war. This war also belongs to the religious wars. The real object was the church. Louis XIV, the powerful king of France, wanted to destroy with one blow that heretical Netherlands. For that reason, he made an alliance with the English king, Charles II. This king wanted to return to the Roman Catholic Church again. Assisted by the bishops of Munster and Cologne, they would first make the Republic harmless, and after that, the English people would also be compelled to completely return to the Roman Catholic Church. And we have seen what that meant with the Huguenots in France, who also had to return to the only saving Mother Church, and therefore they were persecuted to the blood. Louis XIV wrote to the Roman Catholic rulers in Europe, "This war shall serve to the spreading of the faith and punishment of the heretics." It surely was an attempt by the Prince of Darkness to extinguish the light of the gospel. Europe had to become Roman Catholic again. Therefore, the preparations for this war were enormous. Neither pains nor expenses were spared. And when that powerful French army advanced, being armed to the teeth, then according to human reckoning, the French victory was assured. Over against that existed the condition of the Dutch army, which was pitifully bad. John de Witt had splendidly taken care of the navy, but he had not taken care of the army. It seemed as if the French advance could not be stopped. Triumphantly, the hostile army marched into the country. There was hardly any resistance. And yet, God watched. Already at the beginning, at the toll house at Lobith, where the French had crossed the Rhine, the seed of victory for the Netherlands was laid. God rules the world by apparently small incidents. One of the French generals, Condé by name, had in mind to continue straight to Amsterdam with 20,000 horsemen, each with a soldier behind him. In that way, the capital of the Republic would be taken by surprise and occupied. Then the enemy would already be in the heart of the country. Then he would await the remainder of the French army, and in the meantime would sow terror and confusion in the rear of the Dutch troops. Nowadays, the same thing is done with paratroopers, but naturally they did not exist in those days. But Condé wanted to do it in this way. His plan was fatally dangerous, because if that happened, then the Netherlands would have been lost. Then the issue of the war would have been decided from the start, and then the French would have obtained a brilliant victory. Then the persecutions would have commenced anew in the Netherlands, because the final object was to spread the Roman Catholic religion. Isn't that so? But no, in God's counsel, it had been determined otherwise. Close to Lobith, a brief battle broke out between the powerful French army and a small group of Frisians who had lodged themselves in the toll house. Of course, that fight did not last long because the superior forces were too great. That toll house was shot to rubble by the French cannon, and the heroic little troop of Frisians were gloriously defeated and fought unto death. That seemed to be only an insignificant fight, and the French obtained the victory. But in that fight, Conde was wounded in his arm, and nothing became of his beautiful plan. Amsterdam was not conquered, and the enemy never obtained control of that city. The other French generals considered the plan of Conde too risky, and according to them it was not necessary because they would still overpower the Republic. Also in this we clearly see the hand of the Lord, we told you before, often through apparently insignificant things, performing great things. In the midst of the great confusion, when the government did not know what to do anymore, William III, the pale, weak prince, was acclaimed as stadtholder. That commenced in the little city of Vera in Zeeland. The people demanded the elevation of the prince. It could no longer be checked. The one city followed the other. There went the perpetual edit of John de Witt. His perpetuity lasted only 5 years. Although the French flood spread itself ever further into the Netherlands, so that the enemy was already in the center of the land, although the Roman Catholic Mass was celebrated in the Utrecht Cathedral, yet the courage and the confidence of the Dutch people returned again. There was an Orange at the head again. Though our little prince is ever so small, yet he shall be stadtholder after all, had become a fact. John de Witt and his entire clique of regents were not able to stop it. The band, Netherland and Orange, was not severed. When the God-fearing preacher Vucius was asked what he thought of the situation, he answered, "It is only a cloud like a man's hand. It shall blow over." He believed that the Lord would grant deliverance. You may be sure that countless prayers were sent up to God in heaven, and those prayers were answered. Besides, the French-English fleets arrived before the coasts of the Netherlands to attack that country from the west. During a fierce sea battle, their own fleet was heavily damaged and lay in the harbors and could do nothing. The enemy threatened a landing, which seemed unavoidable. If that succeeded, then that country would have been lost. But the Lord intervened again in the middle of the summer. For 14 days together, a southwestern storm arose, and by that storm, the enemy fleet was swept away from the coast. A landing became impossible, and having been damaged severely, while many ships were lost, the remainder of the enemy fleet returned to their own harbors. A day of thanksgiving was observed in the Netherlands, while among the enemies it was remarked that this was something unusual, that this was the controlling hand of God. So many miracles have happened during that war. Those people should never forget the miracles of God in their history. It is true in our days they deny those things, but they cannot be denied. Whosoever wants to know more about this should read The Miracles of the Most High, by Abraham van der Velde, and Judicial Acts by Jacob Frotier. And when the frost set in the winter of 1672 to 1673, for which the French army had waited, and they marched over the frozen water defense line to the center of Holland, then a cry of distress ascended up out of thousands of hearts. God again heard the prayer of that people, because suddenly the thaw set in with rain and wind, and the French army sat in the midst of the water defense line like a rat in a trap. It could neither advance nor retreat. Yet through the treachery and cowardice of one of the Dutch commanders, the enemy escaped, but they had to retreat, and Holland was saved, saved by the Almighty. In 1674, their brave stadtholder, William III, succeeded to capture the fortress of Bonn. This German city had been fitted out by the French as a storehouse for their armies in the Netherlands. If the French troops did not want to be cut off from their country, then they had to retreat, and they did retreat. Although while robbing and looting, yet the enemy had been driven out of that country. In that same year already, England, Westphalia, and Cologne concluded peace. Much could be told about that war. We could tell you more fully how that both John and Cornelius de Witt were brutally murdered. This massacre is a black page in the history of that country. The execution of John van Oldenbarnevelt, about which we told you in chapter 96, is no black page. But the murder of the De Witts is surely a black page. Just bear that in mind. We could tell you how. No, I'm going to stop with that. All that belongs to the national history. In 1678, France also concluded peace with the Republic. They had not lost a square yard of territory. I shall not tell you more about that. The main thing in this case is that the evil plan of Louis XIV to exterminate the Reformation in the Netherlands had failed, completely failed. The great, proud Sun King of France suffered a formidable defeat. Rome had also suffered a tremendous defeat because Rome stood behind it and watched for an opportunity to regain the lost territory in the Netherlands. God had given deliverance. God had used their stadtholder, William III, as an instrument in his hand to call a halt to that intrusive Rome. Not Rome, not Louis XIV, but God reigns. For the present, the threatened danger has been averted. We wrote, for the present, because Louis XIV did not sit still. He could not swallow that he, the mighty King of France, had lost out against that little heretical country of Holland. He pondered upon revenge. Their stadtholder also realized that the struggle was not yet ended. He constantly spoke about the severe thunderstorm which hung above the head of God's church. He proved to be right, because it is 10 years later, the end of October 1688. Upon the tower of the little city of Brielle stands a woman. A cold, raw wind beats her in the face. From time to time, a shower of rain patters down. She seems not to feel it. Her eyes peer continually in the distance. Upon the boisterous sea, with its white-crested waves, bobs a large fleet, which laboriously battles against the strong wind and only slowly moves away. The ships dance wildly up and down upon the grayish-green waves. But yet, even further and further, the ships move away from the coast. Being bent over a little, she stands there and peers. Peers just so long until the last sail has disappeared out of sight into the hazy distance. While shivering, she finally turns around and goes downstairs again. That woman is Mary Stuart, the daughter of the English King James II, upon one of those ships of that powerful fleet which has just put to sea is her husband, Stadtholder William III. When she hears the roaring of the wind, which is ever increasing in strength, howling around the tower of that ancient city, she sighs deeply, and from her heart, filled with cares, a silent prayer arises to God, if he will preserve her husband and bring him safely back again when his task is finished. But why do all those ships sail in this stormy weather upon the boisterous sea? Where are they going, and what is the object of the voyage? Yea, that is quite a history. Just listen once. King Charles II of England died in 1685. His brother, James II, had succeeded him. As we have already told you in the previous chapter, James II was a zealous Roman Catholic, and he was a good friend of Louis XIV, the King of France. The danger threatened again that unitedly France and England would try to conquer the Netherlands, the same also as happened in 1672. We have already told you that the great object of James II was to make England Roman Catholic again. England had to come again under the dominion of the papal chair of Rome. The state of affairs was extremely dangerous, not only for the Netherlands, but also for entire Protestant Europe. Rome tried anew to put forth its claws to destroy the Reformation. Europe had to return again to the darkness of Rome's heresy and doctrine of lies. The light of the gospel must be extinguished again. Oh, Satan never gives up the conflict. Happily, in England, the resistance increased against the plans of the king. But since James II had no sons, but only daughters, and his oldest daughter, Mary, was married to Stadtholder William III, the English Protestants hoped that one day Mary would succeed her father in England. But when, unexpectedly, a little prince was born, the last hope of the English people was dashed to the ground. For that reason, they appealed for the aid of Stadtholder William III. That was rather difficult for the stadtholder, because that meant that he had to fight against his own father-in-law. Yet he did realize the necessity of this if Protestantism in England would not be ruined. But in no wise would he act without the consent of his wife. For that reason, he told his wife what the conditions were and asked her what she thought of that. And do you know what she answered? He who loveth father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. She also realized that it was necessary for the deliverance of Protestantism. From this it appeared again that she was a God-fearing woman. William III promised that he would come. The English gentlemen who had come to Holland departed again, happy and relieved. All preparations for that expedition to England had to be done secretly. Naturally, nothing was allowed to become known, because then James II would take measures and put England in a state of defense. Besides, he could depend upon the support of Louis XIV. The troops were assembled upon the Mooker Heath. Mind you, upon the Mooker Heath, far down in the southeastern section of that country, in various harbors the fleet was made ready. However, Louis XIV did not trust it. For a long time already he had surmised that something was brewing in the Republic, because his spies had told him. He warned his friend James II. However, James II did not believe him and cast his warnings to the wind. When everything was ready, then the troops were brought from the Mukur Heath across the Moose River to the island of Vorn. The fleet was assembled in the harbors of Hellefutslaus and Brielle. Not only a formidable fleet of warships was ready, but also a large number of transport ships to carry soldiers, horses, provisions, cannons, and everything which was necessary for an army to carry them to England. Naturally, everything had to be done as quickly as possible. Finally, the soldiers and all that which belonged to it were embarked. On the 30th of October, the fleet put out to sea. The weather was very unfavorable, rough and stormy. The wind increased more and more in strength and became a gale. The ships tossed to and fro and pitched upon the ever higher whipped up waves. Horses fell down and injured each other. The soldiers, who were not used to sailing, became seasick. Under these circumstances, it was impossible to continue the voyage. And for that reason, the prince gave command to return. The powerful fleet arrived safely in their ports again. Not one ship was lost, but more than 1,000 horses had died. Naturally, those horses had to be replaced by others. But the worst of it all was that everything would now become known in England. And indeed, James II became aware that his son-in-law, William II, aimed at him. The enemies said that was a Roman Catholic storm. With that they meant that this storm was in favor of the Roman Catholics. "No wonder," shouted the Roman Catholics. "The consecrated wafers have been exhibited daily." It seemed as if this great venture was doomed to failure. Yet the prince was not discouraged by this setback. Restlessly, he was busy to repair the losses as soon as possible. New horses were supplied with haste. The damage on and to the ships was soon repaired, and upward of 2 weeks later, the fleet sailed to sea the second time. In the meantime, it had become mid-November. Meanwhile, the wind had turned toward the northeast, and with full sails, more than 350 ships sailed to England. Some writers claim that the fleet consisted of more than 700 ships, but whether that is true, we cannot say. This powerful fleet stood under the command of an English admiral, Herbert by name. William III did not cross over to England to conquer that country, but he had been invited by the English people to help them. This was not a war of conquest on the part of the Republic. It concerned other matters. The flag of William III waved upon the ship upon which the prince sailed. Upon that flag these words could be seen: "For the Protestant religion and the liberation of England. Je maintiendrai." The last words signify, "I shall maintain." Liberty was at stake. Therefore, the liberty of the English people had to be maintained, so that by renewal it would not sink away into the slavish chains of the Roman Catholic domination. It was a beautiful sight, those hundreds of ships with their unfolded sails, driven onward by a strong east wind straight toward England. The King of England thought that the landing would take place on the east coast of England. As fast as he could, he had dispatched some troops to that place, in order, if possible, to repulse the attack. But that was not the intention of William III at all. The fleet set its course for the Strait of Dover. On the 13th of November, the powerful fleet sailed into the English Channel. That same east wind kept the English fleet back. That fleet was anchored in the Thames River and could not sail against the wind to get out into the open so quickly. The prince had planned to land his troops at the little town of Torbay, a little past White. They sailed all night, but when the daylight dawned, to their horror, they discovered that they had sailed past Torbay. It was impossible to turn back against the wind. However, some distance further, an English port was situated, but a strong Roman Catholic force of troops was located in that city. There the landing would be far more difficult and dangerous. But what happened? Unexpectedly, the wind changed to the southwest. The Lord manifested also in this that he has the command over the realm of nature. The sea and the wind are in his hand. The fog which hung there rose, and now they could still land in Torbay. Quickly and orderly, the troops, horses, cannons, and everything that was necessary was brought on shore. Yet this landing remained a great risky venture. How would it go from now on? The army which had disembarked was not so large. The prince counted on the help of the English troops. But yea, could he count on that? When James II heard that the prince had landed in the south, he immediately dispatched English troops to the threatened place to drive the Dutch army back. But the English regiments, which were dispatched to oppose the Dutch, defected to them. William III left those English troops march ahead of him. By that, the stadtholder wanted to show that it was not his aim to subject England to him as a conqueror. On the contrary, he came only to assist the English people against intrusive Rome. Protestantism in England was not allowed to perish. For then Protestantism in entire Europe became endangered. Oh, if the heinous plan of James II had succeeded, the martyrs' fires would have burned again. Then the blood of the martyrs would have drenched the English and Scotch soil again. Then the English people would have been compelled to again return to the Roman Catholic Church. Then it would have gone with England just as in France. There Louis XIV had abolished the Edict of Nantes in 1685, and the Huguenots were persecuted with bloodshed. We told you about that extensively in Chapter 84. Well, then, the same thing would have happened in England, yea, perhaps in entire Europe. For that reason, William III came to England. The troops of William III drew ever nearer to London, the English capital. When James II saw that for him it was a lost issue, he fled to his friend and ally, Louis XIV, in France. Although the French king had repeatedly warned James II, and he had cast his warning to the wind, yet Louis XIV received the English king very friendly. In the meantime, William III made his victorious entry into London. But yea, what now? The English throne stood vacant. Since Mary was the oldest daughter of James II, and hence the crown princess, but also the wife of William III, it was the intention of the English rulers to crown her as queen. Then William III would have been prince consort. Thus it is also in the Netherlands. Juliana is queen, and her husband, Prince Bernard, is no king but prince consort. However, Mary refused that absolutely. What? Would she become queen and her husband, whom she loved so much, no king? Ah, no, she wouldn't consider that. She was willing to become Queen of England and Scotland, but then her husband had to be king. The English rulers, who noticed that the crown princess was serious, yielded to her demand. They gave in to her. On February 23, 1689, William III and Mary Stuart were solemnly crowned as King and Queen of England and Scotland. Who could have ever imagined that? That pale, weak little prince, who always had such headaches, who always had such a tight cough, had now become one of the most powerful monarchs of Europe. How wonderful are God's ways! John DeWitt should have lived to see that. Yet William III did not have much pleasure of the English kingship. The English opposed him in many things. Besides, the damp climate, with its many days of fog, was not beneficial to the health of the prince. He preferred being in Holland. There he felt himself at home. Yet he sacrificed himself for the sake of his great calling to save Protestantism in Europe from perishing. No, William III did not seek honor and glory. He only wanted to be subservient in God's kingdom. Once again, William III did not have it easy. He had a life full of trouble, care, disappointment, and sorrow. Because Louis XIV was an ally of James II, he immediately declared war against Holland. But the Netherlands did not stand alone in this war. Now England did not fight on the side of France against the Netherlands, but stood on their side and fought against France. Besides, William III obtained more allies. The Emperor of Germany and various German rulers and also Spain joined themselves with Holland and England. They all turned themselves against France. Together they would fight to hold back the great conqueror and troublemaker Louis XIV and to frustrate his plans. A French domination had to be prevented. That war raged for 9 years. Naturally, we shall not tell you all what happened during that war because that is not our object. Yet we must relate one thing. We have told you before that Ireland was predominantly Roman Catholic. Well then, James II, who had fled to France, with the help of French troops and the French navy, landed in Ireland. The Irish also joined themselves to the army of James II. That was very dangerous because the object was to build up a powerful army in Ireland. Then they would cross over to England and in this way try to drive William III away. The Prince of Orange realized that too. The sooner that hostile force of troops would be cleared away on that side, the better it would be for everything. Therefore, as quickly as possible, he landed with his army in Ireland and went after the enemy. In 1690, the army of James II was defeated at the River Boyne. James fled to France for the second time. That great danger was also averted, because through this the possibility to recapture the English crown for himself was lost to James II. In the meantime, the war against France raged on. Success and reverses alternated. The war remained undecided. In 1697, France made peace. With this peace, Louis XIV recognized William III and Mary Stuart as King and Queen of England and Scotland. James II has never returned to England. Yet the danger continued to threaten, because Louis XIV had no intention to relinquish his object. He only waited for a favorable opportunity to strike by renewal. And that opportunity came soon. We shall be brief in that which follows. In 1700, the Spanish king died childless. A grandson of Louis XIV was designated by that childless king to succeed him. When the French king heard that, he cried out, "There are no longer any Pyrenees." The high mountain range, the Pyrenees, are located between France and Spain. If a grandson of Louis XIV should rule in Spain, then naturally Spain and France would work together. The situation became dangerous again, because through this the balance of power in Europe was broken again. France and Spain together formed a formidable power. Through this, France would become too strong, and the danger of a French domination existed again. Again, it was William III who frustrated Louis XIV. They had to fight again in order to avert the threatened danger. A bloody war, which lasted 11 years, followed upon this. In this war, the French armies were defeated time and again. But also the Dutch army suffered exceptionally bloody losses. We may say that the core of the Netherlands army was slain. This third war against France is known in history as the Spanish Succession War, because the object was, who would sit upon the Spanish throne? Who would succeed the Spanish king? Stadtholder William III himself did not live to see that bloody war. Although he had made everything ready, yet just before the outbreak of the war, he died. One morning he took a ride on horseback through one of the parks in London. Suddenly his horse stumbled over a molehill. William III, who was not prepared for that, plunged to the ground and broke his collarbone. In itself, that need not be mortal. But whether by all those difficulties his body was weakened so much or something else had set in, at any rate, he died as a result of that fall. But his work was continued by others. And when 11 years later peace was concluded at Utrecht, the power of France was broken. The mortal danger of a French domination, which at the same time would have been a Roman Catholic domination, was warded off. The great plan of France's proud king, Louis XIV, had failed. Completely failed. That has been the work of that pale prince from that heretical little Holland. With the arrival of William III in England, the persecution ceased there. Freedom of conscience for all came there. William III has been the instrument in God's hand to save Protestantism from ruin in Europe. All the princes of Orange are buried in the new church in Delft. But Stadtholder King William III does not lie there. His mortal remains are buried in Westminster Abbey in London. There he rests among the English rulers. That is a place of honor. He deserves that place of honor. There his bones rest. Till the last day, then he shall rise again from the dust. From this history, we also see very clearly the golden thread of God's reign, who caused all things to terminate in the welfare of his church. That same God still reigns. Even today, he still reigns over kings and princes. Even today he still holds the reins of the world events in his hands. We all realize that Stadtholder King William III occupies a great place in the history of that time. Therefore, we also have printed his portrait in this chapter.